Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, December 3rd, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, 4th Annual Garberville Fire Protection Department Spaghetti Dinner Fundraiser raises money for local firefighters' family after tragic loss. Fortuna Housing Plan reflects state law. And 10 Mile Courthouse keeps its doors open as civil cases shift to Ukiah. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On Saturday, December 6th, Garberville Fire Protection District will be hosting their 4th annual fundraiser dinner at the Friendship Hall at the Benbow RV Park. The event goes from 4 to 9 p.m., and tickets are $20 and can be purchased from Redway Liquors, Blue Moon Gift Shop, or the Southern Humboldt Chamber of Commerce. This event is held every year, though this year is different for a number of reasons. Typically, they host a crab dinner for this fundraiser, though due to there not being a crab season this year, they have switched to a spaghetti dinner cooked by local chef Peter Connolly. Unfortunately, shortly before Thanksgiving, tragedy struck Redway Fire Chief Seth Ayers and his family with the unimaginable loss of their son. So the fundraiser has pivoted from raising money for the Fire Protection District to raising money for the Ayers family during this difficult time. KMUD News spoke with Sean Masterson of the Garberville Volunteer Fire Protection Firefighters Association for more information.
Every year, we have an annual crab feed. Typically, it's the first Saturday in December, and this year, we don't have a crab season, so we had to, on the fly, turn to a spaghetti dinner, which is a good thing. We have Peter Connolly, who makes homemade pasta for us, and he's making the sauce. So when he's Peter Connolly, the Irishman, but when he does Italian, he's Pete Cannoli. So he's offered to make the sauce and make the noodles, so it'll be a homemade spaghetti dinner this Saturday down at the Fembo RV Park from 4 to 9. And I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with the tragedy that happened to Seth Ayers' family. Seth is the Redway Fire Chief. They lost their son right before Thanksgiving. And the proceeds this year will go to the account that's set up at the credit union for the Ayers family to help them pay all the expenses that were involved.
The annual fundraiser dinner was started 4 years ago to raise money to pay for the special election that was required to form the fire district. The money raised also went towards operating funds for the fire district.
Well, when we formed the new fire district, we were raising money to pay for the special election that was required. So Measure U required like $10,000 or $15,000 to put the ballot out, which if we didn't raise the money for it, it would come out of the operating funds of the fire district. So we came together and funded about 90% of it through this fundraiser. So then it became an annual event. Measure U passed. With a supermajority of right in at about 80%, which to get 80% of the people in Southern Humboldt to agree on anything, I think is a small miracle. But it required a supermajority because there was an assessment put on everybody's property tax. And the thing that it did for most people is it expanded the district from basically Garberville proper, which was about 412 acres to 36,000 acres, which is now the biggest fire district in Humboldt County, right? So along with that, people agreed to pay an assessment on their property taxes to help fund that. So with that new revenue stream, the department will be able to buy, over time, more equipment to service this huge area, build a firehouse out at Sprawl Creek, which was absorbed into the Garberville Fire Department, and put a firehouse and engine in Benbo, right? So all this stuff takes time. So to help aid in that, we've kept the fundraiser going to help speed up that process. And it's one day a year where people can come together for a good cause and support what's now the biggest fire district in Humboldt County and help make things better. This year, with the recent events, we decided it was more important to support a family that's given to the community than to save money for fire apparatus. So the association, the members of the association can vote on and decide what the fundraising money goes to. And this year, it was a unanimous vote that we need to help out one of our own.
Money is raised at the fundraiser through ticket sales, though there also will be an opportunity drawing where members of the community can win prizes from different merchants around town.
You know, have a dessert table that volunteers make the desserts and we sell the desserts. And we have an opportunity drawing, which we have several things from different merchants around town and town bucks. So you can get a chance, get tickets to have the opportunity to win that drawing.
If unable to attend the event and wanting to donate to the Ayers Family Fund that has been set up by the Garberville Fire Protection District, people can donate directly to the Ayers family through Community First Credit Union in Garberville to the Seth and Mira Ayers Family Fund account. Donations can also be mailed to Seth Ayers and Family in care of Redway Fire, P.O. Box 695, Redway, California, 95560.
Typically, it's a good time. It will definitely be good food. It's only $20. Usually, we've lowered the price because we can't get crab this year. And for a $20 bill, you can get a heck of a dinner. So we have El Forno is doing garlic bread for us. Chautauqua is donating the salad. Peter Connolly is hand-making the noodles and sauce. And the community coming together to help out the fire department. And then we shifted gears because, you know, you can't plan for things like the events that have happened. So I would encourage everybody to help someone who's done nothing but help this community.
Once again, this event will be on Saturday the 6th from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Friendship Hall at Bembo RV Park. For more information, the website is facebook.com/ Friends of Garberville Fire Protection District. Fortuna is rezoning areas of the city, including those in and near the former Pacific Lumber Mill site, to be consistent with state law. Daniel Mintz reports.
Ordinances implementing Fortuna's housing element plan have been introduced, reflecting state law on making supportive and multifamily housing development easier. A key chapter of the city's general plan, the housing element, is a state-mandated plan to provide housing for all income categories. Recent state mandates focus on low-income, transitional, and supportive housing. The intersect between state law and the city's housing element was described at the December 1st Fortuna City Council meeting. Michelle Nielsen, a senior planner with Plan West Partners, the city's planning consultant, said supportive housing is allowed by right in commercial, industrial, and residential areas as directed by state law.
As far as supportive housing developments, it would apply to the multifamily zones, commercial and industrial zones, and the public facilities zones. And what are the qualifications? There's quite a laundry list out of state law. 100% of the units have to be affordable and set aside for lower income households and subject to a 55-year affordability covenant. It must meet the minimum state standards. The state standard for the minimum number of units that will be set aside as permanent supportive housing units. There's standards in state law about that.
The city's Mill District plan area is a significant part of the element's rezoning. About three-quarters of the plan's 104-acre area is made up of the former Pacific Lumber Mill site. The district plan envisions a mix of commercial, industrial, and residential development. Nielsen explained how the housing element rezones a residential portion adjacent to the plan area to allow multifamily housing development by right.
State law requires that a multifamily, at least 20% of the units are affordable to lower-income households, that they be permitted by right. And if they had a lesser number, you know, 15% below that 20% threshold, they would require a conditional use permit. So the language of the qualified combining zone would reflect that housing element requirement, along with a uniqueness of the Mill District specific plan area that we uncovered as we were preparing this.
With 57 of the 79 parcels in the Mill District's adjacent residential area already developed with single-family homes, That housing type will still be allowed, as explained here by Nielsen.
So the uses that will be permitted in under this Q zone would be single-family residential development, including ADUs, will continue to be permitted by right. This is important for the Mill District neighborhood, that area that's adjacent, because most of those parcels are already developed with single-family residences. And this Q zone that is proposed that would continue to permit the single-family residential uses. If that was not made a part of the zoning change, those single-family residential uses would become legal non-conforming uses. And the city zoning regulations have a lot of limitations on rebuilding. If they're rehabbing those units, if something happened to them, or if somebody wanted, the property owner wanted to do an addition. Also, there are financing improvements and reconstruction when a non-conforming use is more difficult as well.
Additional rezoned areas near the Mill District will have similar multifamily housing and single-family home rules. The introduction of the implementing ordinances was unanimously approved, with final approval set for the council's next meeting. Also at the meeting, a $1.5 million transfer from the city's General Reserves Fund into its CalPERS Employee Retirement Payout Fund was approved and will reduce annual interest payments by $130,000. The shifting of funds helps the city cover the costs of police officer salary increases, which also got final approval at the meeting. As did adoption of a ban on retail sales of nitrous oxide, though Councilmember Ave Stevens voted against it. He has previously said use of nitrous oxide is a matter of personal choice. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Coastal residents concerned about losing access to justice can breathe easier, while unlimited civil and family law cases are shifting inland. The 10 Mile Courthouse remains open with a new Zoom room, ensuring locals won't have to make the long drive to Ukiah. Lisa Music reports.
Coastal residents have been anxious about the future of the 10 Mile Courthouse ever since longtime Judge Clayton Brennan retired in late October. Along with rumors of closure, many feared that critical cases would be pushed inland. Court officials say the courthouse is not closing, but some types of cases, mainly unlimited civil, probate, and most family law, will now be heard in Ukiah, because the court currently does not have a coastal judge with the specialized training those cases require. To prevent residents from having to make the 110-mile round-trip drive over the hill, the court has established remote access options, including a full-service Zoom room inside the 10-mile courthouse.
If someone who lives on the coast doesn't either have good broadband or doesn't have a computer or only has a smartphone or whatever, they can go to the 10-mile courthouse and participate in a hearing in Ukiah via Zoom.
Court Executive Officer Kim Turner says these adjustments are part of a transitional period following Brennan's departure, not a sign that Fort Bragg is losing its courthouse.
Under no circumstances do we intend to close it. I know there was a lot of concern when Judge Brennan, who's been the longtime judge out there, retired, but we are not in any way, shape, or form looking to do that at all.
One reason, Turner says, is structural. The new Ukiah courthouse under construction has only 7 courtrooms, but the county is authorized for 8 judges. There isn't room inland to relocate an 8th courtroom.
We're in the process of building a new courthouse in Ukiah, and we only have 7 courtrooms in it, and we have 8 judges. So that should give the residents on the coast real assurance that there is no move to close the courthouse, because we wouldn't have any place in the new courthouse to put us an 8th judge.
While unlimited civil, probate, and most family law matters shift inland, the core coastal caseload remains unchanged. Judge Patrick Pekin is on the coast Monday through Wednesday, handling criminal cases, domestic violence matters, and civil restraining orders. On Thursdays and Fridays, he presides over limited civil cases, small claims, and treatment courts in Ukiah. Turner says this arrangement will remain in place through the end of the year while the court awaits for its newest judge, Charlotte Scott, to be sworn in on December 8th.
Judge Pekin will be out of the coast Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then he comes back to Ukiah on Thursday and Friday to preside over limited civil proceedings for both Ukiah and Fort Bragg in the Ukiah courthouse. And then on Fridays, he's doing adult drug court and behavioral health court in Ukiah. So that is the schedule that we have at the moment. In January, once our new judge has assumed her department, which will be a criminal department in Ukiah, we will be looking at how to come up with kind of a more permanent plan for what's going to happen in 10 Mile.
The shift of certain cases inland is driven by experience. Turner explains that newly appointed judges, often former prosecutors or public defenders, need time and specific training before presiding over complex civil and family matters.
Judges come with all kinds of backgrounds. So when judges are appointed by the governor, most often they come from either a district attorney's office or a public defender's office. So they may not have had any practical experience in probate or in family law or in civil. So our goal is to get all of our judges trained to be able to serve in any department, but they have to have time to go to training, to get the subject matter expertise, to have sort of hands-on experience with those cases. We can't just throw them in the deep end of the pool, because that would be a terrible disservice to the litigants to have a judge that really does not understand the ins and outs of a complicated, unlimited civil case, for example. You know, we want a judge who is experienced in that area to hear that case.
Remote access has now become the backbone of making this structure work. Turner says that for most civil and family law hearings, status conferences, case management, and motions, remote appearances are not just sufficient, but often preferred. Only the rare full trial would likely require an in-person appearance in Ukiah, though that is up to the litigant. And after nearly 6 years of statewide use, remote court is no longer an experiment.
The judges are all now quite comfortable with it. And then I think in a county like Mendocino, where public transportation is poor and the county is quite geographically large and there are areas of it that are difficult to traverse during the winter months, et cetera, you know, remote appearances has been a real, I think, benefit to the public.
The vacancy created by Judge Brennan will eventually need to be filled either by appointment or, if not filled earlier, through an election in 2030. Turner says the appointment process is slow statewide and Mendocino is not alone. COVID-era retirements created a wave of vacancies across California.
So we saw a lot of judges retire in 2020, 2021, 2022, into 2023. It's one of the unfortunate byproducts of COVID.
Despite the strain, presiding judge Keith Falder says the commitment to the coast remains intact. The clerk's office continues to operate 5 days a week, and all priority cases, criminal, domestic violence, and restraining orders, remain in Fort Bragg. As the bench stabilizes with new appointments and caseload reviews, Turner says the court will keep coastal residents at the center of its planning. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Lisa Music.
Turning to Mendocino, in Hopland, steep increases to water and sewer rates have triggered public backlash and a formal legal challenge from residents who say the Hopland Public Utility District violated state law. Mendo Local's Elise Cox has the story.
It's the first week of December, and customers of the Hopland Public Utility District, otherwise known as HPUD, are seeing dramatic hikes in their new water and sewer bills, a 40% increase for water and 25% for wastewater, and the increases will continue. Over the next decade, those rates are set to triple. A group of residents say HPUD did not follow the law when the board voted to raise the rates. Vernon Buttinger, a longtime Hopland resident and management consultant, says the rate increase will have a major impact on residents who are already struggling to get by.
The median individual income is only $32,000 a year, and that's like $2,600 a month. And the average rent is $1,600 a year.
That leaves just $1,000 a month to pay for food, gas, electricity, and other necessities. The pinch brought residents out in force to an HPUD hearing on October 9th, where the board approved the increases. But Buttinger says the board improperly restricted public comment at that meeting by limiting it to 10 minutes in total on the rate increases.
Joe Norrie, the head of the board, limited the comment based on applying the rule that's used for comments that are not on the agenda, and which is 10 minutes, 3 minutes per person. She then applied that to the comment period for an item on the agenda, and that's nowhere in the Brown Act. And not only that, but she said it's Brown Act law, and that's, you know, completely not true. And as a result, it had a hindering effect. You know, for instance, we had a plan that we were prepared to present where we felt that it would meet the needs of the Hopland Public Utility District, and at the same time, wouldn't require such extraordinary rates. But we didn't have time to present it because it was such a short period.
He also says the district failed to release key financial documents in advance of the hearing.
The board was supposed to release financial statements, the financial statements for the 2024-25 year. Their fiscal year ends in June 30th, 2025. They were supposed to release that 72 hours before the meeting. And they released it at the meeting, and we've actually been requesting it, those financial statements, for about a month.
Buttinger adds that HPUD did not complete a legally expected, quote, cost of service analysis, a detailed breakdown that ties expenses to customer rates.
It's a specific analysis that ties the rate increase to actual cost by cost item in the utilities balance sheet. So it's designed by the government and by these professional organizations to provide a fair rate increase to all the ratepayers.
A major driver of the projected increases is a $4.6 million loan HPUD plans to take out in order to relocate sewer lines for a Caltrans project. But Buttinger said the district hasn't produced a valid estimate for the project.
When we pressed them, they had not received an estimate for this. And for a bank to provide you that loan, you would definitely need a class three estimate. And that's, you know, engineer speak or a specific kind of estimate that has to meet certain criteria. And our opinion is that if the bank's not going to give you the money, why should we be giving you the money for this by paying higher rates?
HPUD's position is that two-thirds of the ratepayers failed to protest the increase. Under state law, that means the hike can go into effect. But Buttinger said silence doesn't mean support.
I actually walked in neighborhoods in Hopland. I probably shook the hands of probably 200 people. And of those 200 people, only two people were in favor of it. One was one of the employees at the fire station, and the other was, you know, someone who's affiliated with, you know, the government here in town.
Buttinger's Cure and Correct letter asks HPUD to rescind the October 9th resolution, renotice the hearing, and release a full cost of service study. So far, he says, HPUD has not responded. The law gives them until December 6th. That's this coming Saturday. Buttinger says he's ready to go to court and ask a judge to force the district to obey the law if they don't respond. For KMUD News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Assembly of First Nations Chiefs have voted unanimously to reject any changes to the oil tanker ban off the northern coast of British Columbia. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the resolution came during a First Nations meeting in Ottawa and less than a week after the federal government and Alberta signed a memorandum of understanding about a future pipeline.
The chiefs also voted in favor of requesting that Ottawa withdraw the memorandum, saying it could pave the way for a new pipeline through BC. The national chief of the AFN, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepinak, says Native leaders are united.
Canada can create all the MOUs, project offices, advisory groups that they want, but chiefs are united. When it comes to approving large national projects on First Nations lands, there will not be getting around rights holders.
Prime Minister Mark Carney also addressed the AFN meeting, saying he plans to meet with coastal British Columbia First Nations. Merle Alexander is a lawyer who represents two of those bands.
First Nations in Canada are feeling overwhelmed, that they're feeling as though there is that the duty to consult is being undermined. There also is a real pushback against this regression on environmental and climate change policies.
Last week, Carney and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith signed a memorandum of understanding to cooperate on energy. That opens the way for an exemption from the coastal tanker ban to support a new pipeline to the West Coast and easier access for Canadian oil to Asian markets. The ban has been in place for about 50 years. It bars oil tankers carrying more than 12,500 tons of crude oil from stopping or unloading at ports from the north end of Vancouver Island to Alaska. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
For 5 days, the Indian National Finals Rodeo is held in October in Las Vegas. The older generation passes the torch as up-and-coming riders compete for a shot at a world title. KNPR's Jimmy Romo attended the rodeo and has this story.
Behind the bucking chute at the Indian National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas, or INFR, young riders suit up in their protective gear. There's a good chance a 2,000-pound bull could step on them after they hit the ground. Rodeo hands funnel the bull from their pens to the chute through a series of gates. Then they set them one by one to let the rider get on. When it's time, the gates open. And the animals buck repeatedly, trying to throw the rider off its back. A junior bull rider has to hold on to a bull with one hand for at least 6 seconds to score points. Cassius Thomas, who's 17, held on long enough to secure his win in the Junior Bull Riding INFR World Championship.
Well, I just love the feeling, love the adrenaline, and sure love the money.
Cassius's father, Daniel Thomas, 52, was also a bull rider in his youth. Both are enrolled members of the Navajo Nation.
Oh, the Navajo Nation, I believe this is the way of life, given the horses, the livestock, the sheep. So it all goes back to that.
Children are inspired by watching their older relatives participate in the sport. That was the case for Cassius. It was also the case for bronc rider Ethan Heisman-Yazzie. The 18-year-old finished at the top of his category to win the Rookie Saddle Bronc Riding INFR World Championship. Daniel Thomas was in the stands watching other junior bull riders get thrown before scoring any points. Then it was time to watch Cassius take his turn.
World champion, Cassius Thomas!
The feeling of while the bull was bucking, I could kind of anticipate what it felt like. So I was moving like back and forth, and I was like moving around like I was dancing or something.
Ethan and Cassius will go home with belt buckles and cash prizes, making the trip to Vegas worth the gamble.
That was Jimmy Romo reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lisa Music, Elise Cox, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.